Engamana engareo, ingata wedepumanawa, ro rakatidama, tenakoto, tenakoto, tenatato katoa. Good evening. My name is Harlene Hain, and I have the great privilege of being the Vice Chancellor here at the University of Otago. And on behalf of the university, it is my very, very great pleasure to welcome all of you to this inaugural lecture given by Professor Claire Freeman. Now, these IPLs are always a very special occasion for the university community. It gives us a chance to take a break from all of the other things that we are doing on campus to simply spend an hour listening to the amazing scholarship of one of our own. On behalf of the university, I would like to warmly welcome staff and students who are in the audience this evening. And I would also like to welcome members of the Dunedin public, who I know also use these inaugural professorial lectures as an opportunity to further their own lifelong learning. Last but not least, I would like to welcome Claire's family and friends who are gathered here to support her this evening, including her son Stephen, who has traveled here from Wellington, and who will be feeling justifiably very proud of his mom this evening. We'd also like to welcome other members of Claire's family and her friends who will be watching this podcast from other parts around the world. Now, like all of our promotions here at the University of Otago, the promotion to the rank of the professor comes on the back of years and years of hard work and dedication. In order to be promoted to professor, an individual must demonstrate excellence in teaching, in research, and in service to the university and the wider community. Professor Claire Freeman has clearly excelled in all three of these areas. In terms of research, Professor Freeman was instrumental in the establishment of a subdiscipline of children's geographies. As a developmental psychologist myself, I applaud her efforts in giving children a voice in planning processes that affect them. Claire is also an extremely dedicated and popular classroom teacher, and she has taught extensively at both the graduate and the undergraduate level. Importantly, her work has also had an important impact on the wider planning community. Now, in the course of making our decisions about whether or not to promote someone to professor, we always seek the views of internationally recognized experts in their area of research. And when we sought this kind of input regarding Claire's merits as a potential professorial candidate, we heard a number of extremely laudatory things about her research, like, Claire's work is exceptional for both its empirical rigor and its conceptual commitment to issues of participation and equality. But we also heard things about the value of her work for the practical issue of urban planning, like, Claire's research integrates theory and practice in reflective and insightful terms, while at the same time contributing significantly to local planning knowledge. So Claire, on behalf of the University of Otago, I would like to congratulate you on your well-earned promotion to professor, and I will now call on Professor Tony Binns to tell us just a little bit more about your academic journey. Norera, tenakoto, tenakoto, tenatato katoa.
Kia ora. Lovely to see you all tonight. I think this attendance tonight, the lecture theatre is almost full. I think it's indicative of what we're going to have a fascinating topic, but I think it's also indicative of the support that Claire has in this university and the fact that you're here to support her on this very important occasion. It gives me very great pleasure to have the job of introducing Claire as a colleague and a friend. It's great that she's here, and I think this is a well-deserved promotion, and it's great that she's able to talk to us tonight at her inaugural lecture. I actually have something in common with Claire. We were both born in Lancashire in the UK, 20 kilometres apart. I checked up that, but it does take 27 minutes because you've got to get through the Manchester traffic. She was born on what we call the Plains of Earlham in a place called Lee, whereas I was born nearer to the Pennine Mountains. So where and when she was born, it was shrouded by a pall of smoke because it was very much a coal mining area. Where I was born, you had a textile mill in every valley. Of course, both of those have long since gone. Claire has had a really fascinating family and professional life. Born in Lee in Lancashire, her father was a colliery worker, and mother came from a family of carpenters and bakers. I'm not sure how they combined the two, but I'm sure they managed it somehow. But because her father was a colliery worker, she ended up going all over the world because her father later worked in the gold mines of South Africa. So that will be reflected in the sort of history, Claire's career, very much so. Claire has a very strong commitment to family, and it was interesting that the Vice-Chancellor mentioned her family. I know several of them are here tonight. Claire has four children of her own and has done a wonderful job over her lifetime of caring for other children who've needed support in various ways. Just a few weeks ago, I think it's probably less than a month ago, she became a grandmother. And her daughter lives in Plymouth in the UK. And Claire was, I met Claire at a conference in London, and she'd just come from Plymouth where she saw her grandchild. Claire did her degrees at four universities. Most of us just did, say, two universities, but she did a bachelor's at Rhodes University in South Africa, a higher education diploma at University of South Africa, which is based in Pretoria, and then her master's degree was at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, and her PhD was from Leeds Metropolitan University. So you can see the sort of South African phase there in her life. She's worked in five universities, again, probably more than most of us. First of all, at Rhodes University in Grahamstown in South Africa, where our colleague Etienne Nell used to work. The University of North West, which is in the far northwest of South Africa, almost on the Botswana border. She had a posting up there. I think most people would probably dread a posting up there. It's actually quite an interesting area. I found that area very interesting. And then Leeds Metropolitan University, then Massey University when she came to New Zealand, and then last but by no means least, here at Otago, where she's been director of the planning program for 15 years, and I think she did a sterling job in building up planning here at Otago. We have a wonderful planning course now, and Claire really played a key role in getting that going. In terms of her research, 5 books, 14 book chapters, 65 articles on a whole range of issues like environmental planning, planning for urban nature, planning and young people, sustainable development and community planning. She recently had a Marsden grant on natural neighbourhoods for city children. And her publications are really fascinating. I've read a few of them in preparation for today. She wrote a fascinating paper on camping grounds as spaces of resistance to protective planning. She wrote a paper on household relationships with gardens. In fact, I was part of that survey. I had your research assistant came and interview me and was spotting all the birds in my garden and one thing and another. But I think possibly my favourite paper is one on disaster impact and recovery, where she was up in Christchurch and interviewed no fewer than, I think, 94 children, all about their perceptions of the reconstruction process after the earthquake. Some fascinating responses. And in the article, Claire points out that these children were incredibly resilient and very forward-looking in terms of their views for the development of their city. So just a sort of sprinkling there of the sort of work that Claire has done over the years. And today we have a fascinating topic which combines her interest in people of all ages, including children, but also elderly people as well, but also the environmental side and the planning side. So without further ado, I'd like to hand over and give a warm welcome to Claire Freeman. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Tony Binns. We won't talk with Lancashire accents tonight, but there's a smattering there. Thank you, Tony Binns, very much for your words. And thank you to the PVC, Tony Ballantyne, for coming here. And thank you to all of you who've come, to all my colleagues, to friends, to the family who've come here. And thank you to students. I can see quite a few of you scattered around. Thank you very, very much for coming here. And thanks to my mum who bought me the fancy gown. But she can't come here. And before I begin this talk, I'd like to acknowledge the Mana Whenua. I'd like to acknowledge Ngāi Tahu. And I've had the privilege of working in Otago for many years now. So thank you very much. And to all of you, tena koutou, katoa, thank you. Okay, so this lecture here is about planning biodiversities for all ages. And in order for cities to work, they have to work for the whole spectrum. They've got to work for children, they've got to work for older people. They have to work for all the inhabitants, and not just working for all the inhabitants, the people, they've got to work for wildlife. And what I'm going to do is to talk about how we can make cities work for wildlife and for people. But what's happened is that in looking at cities, the attention has been given to the built. It's often been given attention at the expense of and to the exclusion of the natural environment. And what I argue is that you can't have good cities. You can't create good cities. You can't create the best cities for people to live in unless you have both and look at both of them. So that's what I want to talk to you about today. And I want to take you with me on the journey. It's a journey that I've come from and I've taken in different places, as Tony said, with different people at different career stages. But it's a journey that I couldn't have undertaken without the support of many, many people. And I'd like to thank all those people, and I'll thank them again later on. So what am I going to talk about? What I'm going to do is to argue that cities can and should coexist. And what we've got here is an opening picture which shows the way that nature brings people together of all ages. And this is a young lad and his granny together in the veggie patch, a very sort of New Zealand scene. So if we look at planning, I'd argue that planning plus nature plus people equals biodiversity. And what we can do is we can see it in this wonderful photograph here, which Jinty McTavish took. And it's of a stream in Seoul. This stream used to be an overpass. It used to be a motorway. What happened was that they removed the motorway and reinstated the stream in 2005. It was quite controversial, but they did it. And what we can see if we look at this picture is the joy that nature brings. We can see the people out, we can see the children going across the stepping stones, we can see the fellow with the umbrella here spotting something. There are fish in this stream. It's a bit weird, though, because it's a bit artificial, because what they do is they pump the water around on the stream, and it actually goes counterclockwise. It doesn't run down to the sea, it runs the other way. However, that said, it's actually a wonderful place, and if you go at night, you'll see the musicians there. However, to look at biodiverse cities, what I'd argue is that you've actually got to look at nature in a different sense. You've got to look at nature differently from the way you look at nature in the rural and in the pristine. You've got to adopt a different lens. So what I'd argue is that if we're looking at nature in an urban setting, it's about interaction. It's about how people interact with it. It's about the everyday. It's about the common. It's about what we see around us in our homes. It's dynamic and it's changing. It's constantly readjusting as the city grows or the city shrinks. It's robust. And we can see this in this tree. This tree is robust enough that it can hold up four children. And it's robust enough that they can bounce and make it go up and down. And it's local and it's valued by people. These children value this tree because of the propensities for play that it gives them. So in looking at the urban, we have to look at people's values, and I'd argue that in cities, these values that people put on it have been given limited scientific recognition, and I think we've got to challenge that and perhaps change that. So, can nature people and cities coexist? And I'd argue, obviously, yes, they can, but I'd argue that in many ways they actually do already coexist. One of our research applications was called, "Do you have stick insects in your garden?" That was our garden study. And actually, yes, we do, but we don't tend to see them. And I don't know if you can see on that slide there, can you spot the stick insect? They're there, but you've got to look very hard. And I think what we need to do is to look quite hard at our environment and see what's there and to value what's there and not just ignore it. It's only a stick insect. Stick insects are actually quite important parts of our urban ecology. So I'm a planner, as Tony said, and I studied planning in Birmingham. And as a planner, there's planning on the large scale. There's magnificent planning. And I think what we see here is magnificent planning in Brisbane. It's a great city. But we see planning and its ability to transform. And what we see here on the north bank here is 1960s, 1970s planning, when planning was about getting people into the city as fast as possible, building motorways, building roads. It wasn't about looking after the what's underneath here. It wasn't about looking after the natural environment underneath. However, if we move to the South Bank, what we see here is we see planning in the late 1990s, where planning starts to transform and recognize it's about people, it's about environment, it's about culture. It's a very, very different way of planning. So at this point, I'm not going to talk about big planning, brilliant though it is and exciting though it is. I'm going to talk about planning at the intimate scale. So let's just zoom in here to this little point here, and I'll explain what I'm talking about. In the restoration of that particular site, they created little nature areas. And what they did was they created the opportunity for encounter. You see this water dragon here, and you can see a little intimate encounter going on between this man making connection with that water dragon. It's these things that make our experience of the cities important. Now, that's in an exotic place. Let's go closer to home. And this is one of our students walking to the university. And you can see he's having a little intimate encounter with this white duck. And the duck's not special in itself. It's an exotic duck. Unfortunately, he should really be having an encounter with the black-backed gull, which is a native. However, the point is that we're having these intimate encounters. It's happening. And that student probably feels better for it. It makes us feel good. He didn't know that I was taking a photograph of him at the time. So planning is about the transformative potential, and it's about creating the potential in fairly challenging environments. This is a fairly typical environment of the terrace housing in Sheffield, taken last year. And the most we can see is a little bit of green here and a little bush here. But what they've done is if we come out of this terrace, we come down here, into this area here. It's a piece of derelict land, and what they've done is they've transformed it with wildflower seeds. And look at the riot of colour that we can do. And this is what's happening in our cities. We're starting to transform them. We're starting to challenge this as the built environment. And it's not just in Sheffield it's happening. I took this last week when I was visiting my new grandson from... I was on a double-decker bus. You can just see one here. And I spotted this. So I got off the bus and I went to the roundabout, and what they've done is they've sown wildflower seeds in a roundabout. They've created this potential. What you can't see on here is they've also planted flax, tussock, and cabbage trees. However, it's a riot of colour on a Plymouth roundabout. People do it as well. It's not just local authorities. People do it. And here in Amsterdam, we can see this footpath here has been transformed into a little biodiverse area. And That's been done by the individual, so people connect with nature in the places where they live. So how does this connection happen? And Tony's already told you a little bit about how it happened for me. So how did this interest and this connection with nature happen for me? And if I go back to Lee in Lancashire, where I was born in this house here. And if I think about my past, what have I got? Behind our house, it was pitland. It was collieries. Collieries were always waterlogged. If you went to there now, and my dad worked down the pits, and as Tony said, my mother was from a family of bakers and carpenters. So my family comes from Lee, and that area was an industrial area. So behind our house, only about a kilometre away, you had that sort of landscape. If you went there now, what would you see? You'd see Pennington Flash, this area here. It's been transformed and rehabilitated, and that's one of the premier birdwatching sites now in the northwest. It's got 230 species of birds there. And as a child, my granddad used to take me to Lilford Park to see the deer in a paddock. You don't need to go to Lilford Park to go in a paddock because the deer have become wild and they've come back. And also, as I was a youngster, I started my affinity with animals. And one of the animals that most made an impression was the rag and bone man coming down on his horse. Clearly, this isn't the same horse. I took this picture. But we used to go out and we used to pat this horse, and it was really quite exciting. And animals also became part of my life here. We've got my dog here, my first dog, Prince. And I used to walk him down the Thames and see this wonderful natural place. And I also had rabbits. And prophetically, this white rabbit, believe it or not, turned out to be a New Zealand white. I was going to have a rabbit on my flyer for my professorial, but given the rather controversial position of rabbits in New Zealand, we went for the rabbitless flyer. But what I also want to talk about is I had a wandering childhood. I had a childhood that was free, were out and about, and this is one of the very few photographs we've got. So what we've got there is a bonfire. November the 5th was a big event when this was in Nottinghamshire. And we used to go around and collect wood from the woods, but we'd also try and sneak wood from the builder's yards because we were on a building site and make sure that the watchy didn't catch us. But this idea of wandering and this idea of being out and about, we were always out and about just for interest. That's my brother, that's my brother, that's my sister, and that's me in the middle. So that's four of my family. This idea of a wandering childhood is something that I now have in my research. This is a picture taken from the one of the Adventure Playground, and it's taken from a book, Child in the City, by Colin Ward. And when I was a student, I went to a book sale and they had this book for sale for 20 cents. I used it to prop up my desk, and years later I realised it was going to be the most influential book I ever read when I finally took it out. And when he wrote the book Child in the City in 1978, it was full of these absolutely fantastic black and white photographs of children being out and about. And the sort of things children got up to. I don't know if you spotted the fellow up at the top there. But it wasn't just children in the United Kingdom. It was children here. And this is a photograph from Woodhull Gardens, probably about the same time. Colin Ward redid this book in, when did he do it? 1990. He released this book without the pictures, because by 1990 he couldn't take the photographs of the children being out and about. The wandering carried on, and this was a very important site where I developed an affinity to nature. It's Marlow Common. And what you see here is a fantastic site. And if you see this here, you can just see these trenches. This was a site used for digging trenches in World War I. The poor soldiers had to go and practice trench digging. And what that meant was that for us as kids, it was a fantastic playground, going in and out of these trenches through the ferns. But when I went back, you don't see children there now. These children that are on this photograph were being supervised by their parents. They didn't have the freedom to be out and about in quite the same way that we had. The first piece of research I did was on children, where they are, whether they're out and about, and looking at what's happening over time. This was a piece of research I did in 1995 in Leeds, where I was living and where I started to raise my family. These numbers here refer to children that were observed out playing during summer holidays in 1995. And you can see it's quite a constrained area. Most children, 36, are out on what was then a pit, a slag heap, and they're mostly motorbike riders. When I asked the parents in 1995 where they played as children, these are the hatched areas, and we can see it's a much greater area. But it's so great that it doesn't actually fit on the map. So what we have to do is we have to go here to the little inset, to Rothwell Pastures, Temple Newsome, Methley, and right out to Fairbanning's. Children were going about 20 kilometres away, and they were going from age 8 to 9. The biggest change was that the parents, there was no gender difference. But in 1995, a significant gender difference had come in, and I started on children's geographies. Okay, so how did I start my academic career? And it started here. It started in South Africa. I went and I got offered a job, and when we went on a tour, we're told these are the houses that are being prepared for staff. However, when I got there, they said, no, we haven't finished your houses. You get a caravan. So this was my university housing that I was given for my first job. And it was during a drought, and the 1982 drought, and the locals used to come and water their cattle at our tap by our caravans. So this was where I began as an academic and where I really had my first interactions with students. Amazing people. They were absolutely fantastic. And this is one of our field trips where we went down a gold mine. I don't know that we could take students down a gold mine here, but that was one of the things we did. And I began researching. I began researching, looking at the people-environment relationship, and that's where I still am today. So one of my early pieces of work was on drought and looking at whether the poverty and the hardship on those people in the villages of Kunana and Disaneng, was it due to meteorological change, as in drought, or was it due to other things happening? And it certainly was due to other things happening. So the drought impacted. These children came out of their school. Children couldn't go to school because their parents couldn't sell a cattle beast. They were too thin. So they couldn't get fees to send their children to school. The drought impacted on donkeys. The local government decided to shoot the donkeys because they were eating all the grass. So the people had no transport and they had no donkeys the next year to plow. Also, the builders were out of work because there was no water to make the bricks to build the houses. So it has all sorts of impacts. And that was some of the early research that I looked at. At that point, I then moved back to Britain and I trained as a planner and started to work for the Urban Wildlife Trust, which is the first of the wildlife trusts in Britain, the oldest one. It began in the 1980s. And our first success at that Urban Wildlife Trust was the saving of Moseley Bog. Now, you've probably not heard of Moseley Bog. Who had? I mean, people in Birmingham haven't heard of it. But Moseley Bog was seen as the inspiration for Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, because Tolkien was brought up just close to there. And now, after Lord of the Rings, you now get people enacting Gandalf and these others wandering around Moseley Bog. So I started to become concerned about urban nature and urban ecology, and there were some people, some experts working on it, and someone called W.D. Teagle wrote this book in 1978 called The Endless Village. And what he said was that cities are a series of built settlements joined by natural spaces, leftover spaces, and in the Black Country, often spaces that used to be pits and industrial. Actually, his name, he didn't go by W. Teagle. He went by the name of Bunny Teagle. There's a bit of a rabbit theme going on here. And in 2008, Endless Village was revisited, and his work and those of whom he has inspired has moved nature conservation from the preserve of scientists, naturalists, and bureaucrats to its rightful place as something relevant to everybody's daily lives. But for the planners, and I see we have some planning colleagues here, it also is encapsulated by that slope, S-L-O-A-P, that space left over after planning. And those are the very spaces that nature begins to inhabit. So what are the experts telling us? And here are just three working in that field. We've got the biophilia hypothesis by Kellett and Wilson, and that's the innate tendency to focus on life and lifelike processes. And I like the last bit of that, hope rises on its currents. The second one is eco-psychology, and that's the notion that nature heals. If we're in touch with nature, it's good for our physical and emotional well-being. The third one in 2005, and this is a much more recent one, is by Richard Louv. And what Richard Louv argues is that the bond is breaking between the young and the natural world. And he coined this term, which I think is particularly awful, but it's very commonly used, of nature deficit disorder. So that's what the experts are saying. At this point of this rapid rise in interest in nature conservation, I came to New Zealand. And I landed at Massey. I landed at Massey University. And I came to a very, very, very different place. I came in 1997, and Mount Ruapehu, who had recently erupted. And the planning handbook, I couldn't get the original photograph, sorry, but the planning handbook had Matthew Park standing with his arms raised like this, standing on the mountain with it erupting in the background. And I asked Matthew for a copy of this, and he said he couldn't find one. But what we see here is Matthew and his companion racing down the mountain as it erupts. So it was clearly a very different land that we moved to. And I had to teach a block course after being in the country about 4 or 5 days. And the students, I asked them what their essay was about that I had to mark. And Matthew said it was about Kaitiakitanga. And I said to Matthew, I said, what's that? He said, don't worry, you'll get to know. And indeed I have, because Kaitiakitanga, we can see the definition here, is an inherent obligation we have to our tupuna and to our mokopuna to safeguard and care for the environment of the future generations. And it's not just Kaitiakitanga, it's Kaitiakitanga and about the relationship that we have with people. And there's a Maori proverb that is also quite important and influential here. And this is, what is the most important thing? He tangata, he tangata, he tangata. It is the people, it is the people, it is the people. And it's this relationship between the land and the people that has inspired me in a lot of my work. If we look at Kaitiakitanga, we can see it at work here in the Orakanui Eco Sanctuary, where the focus here, and we've got Neville Pete, who's given a lot of his time here, and I've been involved in this, and it's about looking after the land. It's about the land and building up the land for our mokopuna to pass on for future generations. But how do we care for biodiversity and foster natural relationships in a built environment? This is one of our garden study respondents. It's through feeding the birds. It's a much more difficult task that we have in the urban environment. So as a planner, what I want to do, I want to work with people about creating better environments, more natural environments. But you can't do that if you don't know what is there. So one of the first pieces of research I did when I came to Otago in 1999 was we worked on habitat mapping to try and establish what is the nature, what is the habitat that is around us. And we developed a classification system, and we've developed these maps. There have been lots of natural habitat maps before, but they'd look just at the open space. What we looked at was all the spaces, the industrial, the gardens, the streets, and we classified all of them. This map has been used in a number of studies. It's been used in Yolanda Van Heesick's cat study. Yolanda's on sabbatical, so can't be with us, but I've worked with her ever since, and is wonderful work, wonderful scientist she is. And what she did was she looked at where cats are going and what habitats they were using. And you can see the black where the cat goes. And what you can see is that the cat here is going in bush and forest. And this is important in relation to predation activities of domestic cats. It's also been used by Renaud Mathieu using satellite imagery to try and establish what are the habitats. We tried to use Iconos imagery to see if we can have a rapid way of producing these maps, but things aren't actually as rapid as you'd like. But what he did was he produced maps that showed the garden density, more dense gardens here and in the Dunedin North. That's because the gardens are smaller, there's more of them, but they're actually, in terms of habitat, not as good. They're not as rich in vegetation. That led us to the garden study, where we had this wonderful team of people here on our right-hand side working together. Entomologists, zoologists, plant ecologists. So what we wanted to know is 36% of the urban area is garden, and we know very, very little about what goes on in gardens. Scientists generally hadn't directed their attention to gardens. It's been a wonderful study. We've had quite a lot of papers. I think it's about 9 papers, and we actually discovered a new species in this research. Unfortunately, it wasn't a particularly beneficial one. It was on the mass unwanted organism list. But we found it. We found it. We looked at the skinks, we looked at the birds, we looked at the vegetation, but we also entered a voyage of discovery about what is it that matters to people in their gardens. And we found that there's a number of things that matter. Escapism. People use their gardens to de-stress after work. A lady told us, I go into my garden so nobody can find me. About ownership and identity. One man has 200 rose bushes. And it's how you can create whatever your identity, whatever you want. It's about connectedness to nature, and it's about social relationships. People talked about going into the garden to talk to family members in times of distress. One man said, when I was growing up, I thought that flowers were for pansies. And now, pansies not as in the flower itself. But now he's actually a member of the Dahlia and the Chrysanthemum Club. And he takes flowers to the, what he says, the old folks' homes, as he calls them. It's also about a duty of caring. People say, we can't save the world, but we can look after our little patch. We can do our thing. It's about health. People grow vegetables through weeding, particularly older people. It keeps them active. And it also helps with the emotional and mental well-being. And production, 52 of our 55 householders grew vegetables. And they also showed us some of the spirituality. Everyone should do it. It's good for their souls. And it's an attempt to recreate what we destroyed. So we got a lot out of this garden study. And the garden study is about people and their relationship to land. So this brings us to something where I've done a lot of work. And this is our children's part of our work. And as planners, it is incumbent on us to know about the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. The United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child in New Zealand was an early signatory, states that in all actions concerning children, whether undertaken by public or private social welfare institutions, courts of law, administrative bodies, or legislative bodies, the best interest of the child shall be a primary consideration. So our research says, how do we know what the best interests of the child are? How is it that we can plan for them? We need to know what children want and what their best interests are. And the second part of it is that the child who is capable of forming his or her own views shall have the right to express those views freely in all matters affecting the child. In all matters affecting the child, whether it be housing, transport, play, leisure, education, the child should express their views. And as planners, most of what we do influences children. So how do children use their environment? And this was a study that we've done over a number of years, looking at children's neighbourhoods. Now, we use different methods, and one of the methods that's often used is getting children to draw maps. And we interpret those maps. And these are maps of 2 children in Brockville. And what we see with the map on, is it right or left? That one. sorry. We see a very detailed indication of that child's life, where they go, what they do, the skate park, and it gives us a really good insight. If we look at the child, this child here, that doesn't tell us very much. We could, if we just ask the children for those maps, make some serious errors of interpretation. Because what we could say is, this child has a really good idea of its neighbourhood, this child doesn't. When we talk to the children, we actually found out that they both know equally the same. They both travel, they both go around the same. And of course they do. They're actually twin boys. It's one of our twin studies. So, but this child is academically more gifted than this child. So it just shows the importance of using different methods and talking to children if you want to understand their lives. We've also used aerial mapping, where we get the children to directly show us on computers through GIS what it is that they do. These trees are play areas. We've got named neighbours, we've got friends, we've got other people, we've got relatives. So we build up an idea of how the children use that. And in Brockville, there is a very strong sense of community amongst those children. We've also looked at children's neighbourhoods in Fiji and Kiribati. We use similar methods. We got the children there to draw maps. We want to see how the urbanisation process is changing their lives. So we interview the children, we talk to them here, and then we ask them to draw the map. And this child talks about how after school I go straight home and change my uniform. After changing my cloth, then I spend time gardening with my uncle. This is growing cassava and it's growing darlo, which is part of children's lives there. Then on holidays, I always go to swim at Suva Point. This is Suva Point. It's a highly polluted, not particularly nice part of Suva, and how very different this is from the pristine beaches that the tourists go to. But this is where our children go. From the Children and Neighbourhood Study, we then were fortunate enough to get some Marsden funding to look at children's connections with nature. And we wanted to explore what Louvre was telling us. Are children suffering from nature deficit disorder? Are children removed from nature? And what we wanted to do was to ask the children themselves and to explore that. I worked with scientists on this, and we adopted some scientific methodologies. And one of the methods we adopted was, if you have a possum and you want to know where it goes, you catch the possum, you drug it, you put a radio collar on, and you record in blue dots where it goes. Clearly, we don't want to and can't do that with our children. What we do is, but we do want to know where they go. We want to know what habitats the possum uses. We want to know what habitats the children use when they go out to play. So we gave the child a mouse and a computer, and they indicated through the red dots where they go. They showed us some more detail about what they do. They told us about, this is a child in Wellington, where they see the birds, where their friends are, where they go to play, where you can go and see natural water, where they walk along here, and a whole range of other things. This is a quiet nature place that the child goes. So we got directly from the children an indication of what it is they do and where they go. We then took some of those scientific methods. These are the dots where the children actually go. But what we did was, Kate did this, Catherine Hand, she generated random dots of where the children would go if they had the ability to do so. So what we can see here is that if we randomly do it, the children should be in the woodland, but they're actually not. The children are mostly on the playing fields here and at the school. Now, we know that although there may be habitats available in the city, the fact that they're there doesn't mean that children can use them. So what we did here was, all these dark orange blocks are where the children can't go. A child can't just wander into someone else's garden because it's there. You have to remove those from the equation. So we did a buffer around the child's home here, 500 metres. These lighter areas are where they can use, and the streets, the orange areas where they can't go. We then added on the background of what the habitats are. You've seen this a few slides ago. This is Sarah, whose map we just looked at. We looked at what habitats they can and can't use, and we worked with the ecologists on this. We then saw if there was any relationship between deprivation and biodiversity, and indeed there is. So if we look here, this is the buffer zone of the child in the richest biodiverse area. This is the buffer zone around the home of the child in the least biodiverse area. There's a child living in a flat in central Wellington. So what does all this tell us? What it tells us is a couple of things. It tells us that if we look at where children are using, they're mostly using their own gardens. They're actually avoiding here the woodland and the natural groups of habitats. So children are not using the most biodiverse areas. They're there, but they're not using them. Does this mean then that Louv is correct and that children are disconnected from nature? And the answer is no. Because what we did was we said to the children, if an alien came and they didn't know what a bird was, they didn't know what a bug was, they didn't know what natural water is, could you show this alien where these things are? And indeed they could. But what they did was they showed these things in quite small home ranges. Whereas if you'd taken me as a child, I'd have been 8, 9 miles away. These children were doing it around their home, but they still are connected to nature. We had another study that was older children. We asked ourselves, what can young children tell us? I'm just going to talk about the last two little bits of research that we did. What can preschoolers tell us? Because we've been told that preschoolers can't conceptualize the city. It's beyond them. If we ask them about the city and we ask them to create a city, they will randomly distribute the elements. So did they? We've got two wonderful people here. Christina, who can't be with us because she's got a 3-day-old baby. And Tess, who helped in this study. And what we see in this picture is two little girls in downtown Seoul who discovered a rabbit as they were walking. Right? And you can see the joy that comes with that nature connection. That rabbit clearly isn't wild. How it got there, we don't know. But the connection is epitomized in the joy of the stance of those children. So can children tell us about the cities? This is a child aged 3 years, 9 months. What we did was we said, will you create a city for us? We had tiles, they asked for tiles, and then later they could choose tiles at will. And this is what they showed us. They created some quite impressive cities. We see here the town hall. We see the blocks of flats here. This one went over the edge of the city. Actually, this is urban sprawl, isn't it, in action. We have a boy here, 3 years, 3 months, creating quite a complex city. The child who used most tiles used 334 tiles. That's a lot of tiles. The longest a child took uninterrupted on this exercise was 2.5 hours. The most features that a child used was something like 56 out of 66. The children really did know what they were doing. We're still analysing the data, but they knew what elements were in the city. About 60% of them could show us the main elements. They could show us the patterns and the clusters that were going on, slightly less able to show spatial relationships, and there is an age developmental thing going on here. But by and large, they understood the places that they live in. What about nature? How did nature do on this? And green space came up as the second commonest tile that our children used. And not very far behind were fauna. And we can see here the fauna, the butterflies, the ants, some of the flowers, the ladybirds that they were creating, so they recognise nature as part of the city. So this is the last piece of research that I want to talk about, and it brings together a lot of those concepts and a lot of those ideas that I've been talking about. And here I'd like to acknowledge Deborah Waters, the gerontologist, and Yolanda Van Heesick, who are working with us on this study, and it's ongoing at the moment. So nature and ageing, it combines the earlier themes, and it's really important because we're in an ageing society. The cost of health provision to the ageing population is one of the biggest costs that our government faces. And we know that nature enhances well-being physically and it enhances well-being emotionally. So if we can use nature to do that, it can seriously impact on the resources that we need and on our general healthcare. And our question was, how does aging affect older adults' ability to encounter and engage with nature? And at this point, I'd like to thank the wonderful Yvette, who's sitting here, and she does all the interviewing with our people. And this man said we could use this photograph. And they, what we do is we go into people's homes and we look at their relationship with nature when they're in the family home, when they're in the downsized home or the unit, and as they go into rest homes. So we're tracing that because we know from the garden study that some people felt very frustrated. They didn't want to move into a more possibly appropriate-sized home and leave the garden. It was a great loss for them. But also, it was frustration because they could no longer look after it. So what you can't see, and you can never catch it on photographs, is this too is feeding on sugar water in this basket here. But whenever we took the photograph, the tui disappeared. But they were there. So this couple look out of their window and watch the tui. We asked people, what matters to you? And they took us around their garden and they showed us some photographs of the things that matter to them. And again, these people said that I could use this for this particular lecture. And what we've got here from the one lady is the cyclamen. The cyclamen was in her mother's garden, and it's been transferred from various places, from Whangarei, and it's now here in Dunedin. It's a sense of connection, and we've actually got the granddaughter in here with us today. And the second one is a tree where our respondent tells us she likes to look out at that tree and watch the birds. The husband isn't as keen on gardening, but what he did say to us, he likes this rose because it's the red rose. It's the red rose of Lancashire, and he's from Liverpool. What we've got here is not a natural feature, but it's important. And what this is the non-slip surfacing that the sun's created. I don't think they laid it themselves, but they created so that their parents wouldn't fall and slide because they live in a very icy part of the city. But it also means that she can get up to the greenhouse without fear of falling. So we also mapped people's everyday relationships. This is someone, and one of our respondents is his house, a functional space, usually a washing line. This is where he socializes, where he sits, where he grows vegetables, where he looks at the flowers. So we're building up, again, an idea of how people relate to the areas around them. And if we went further out, he would show us where he walks to in his neighborhood. So what are some of the findings from this study? Aging changes the relationship. It changes, perhaps as you stop work, you've got more time to go and walk in the mountains, or to go and visit places, or to go to the beach every day. But as frailty comes upon you, it can also change that relationship. You can't get into the garden to do the gardening. You kneel down, but you can't get up. It changes that relationship. For some, it enhances the relationship, and people have more time to spend in nature. For others, it's reduced as health and other things impact on it. Or you can't drive. You can't drive to the beach. You become dependent on buses. So for many of our people, what happens is that the areas that they can access become smaller. So those smaller areas become particularly important parts of their life. The connection with nature can be closely related to health, but not just your health, your partner's health. If your partner becomes sick, that impacts on you. So it's also about your health relationship with others. For all of our people, nature connection is important, but it's not always obvious. You have to talk to people. So what do all these studies tell us? From preschoolers to older people, nature connection matters at all stages. Well-being or lack of it has a close relationship to the everyday. And people and children are very competent analyzers of their own environment. They know what works. They know what doesn't. And if we talk to them, if we as planners talk to them, or geographers or researchers, then we'll get these insights. And I'd argue that it's imperative that researchers examine the intimate scale, that they examine the everyday that people do. So let's just quickly go back to our experts. What do our experts say, and have they got it right? And yes, we see evidence of the biophilia hypothesis. We see the spirit rising on its currents. We see the relationship that people have with lifelike processes. Nature healed, yes. We see the relationship very strongly at all ages between health and ecology. However, the answer is yes, yes, no. We don't buy into, from our work, we say that nature is important for children, that relationship is changing, but we don't believe the bond is breaking. What we do believe is that as a society, we have to try and ensure that children can access the nature that's there, and that's something that's not happening. But the bond certainly is there. So to finish with some final words, understanding the everyday enables researchers to help policymakers, designers and planners understand what people value, need, and how best to include it in everyday life, or at the very least not exclude it. We exclude often as planners, even by accident, because we don't know what's there. We need to know what's there to make sure we respect and retain it. And it's in the everyday spaces that nearly all life is lived. 86% of New Zealanders live in urban areas. And I would argue that at least 86% of our time is spent in that urban area and around our home. That's where we spend most of our lives, and that's the place that we have to make work. So for all of us, a sense of connection, belonging, care, and responsibility is fundamental to the well-being of people and the land on which we live. So this is the end of what I wanted to talk about with research, but none of the work that I've talked about has been done by me alone. It's been teamwork, it's been work with some wonderful people, and it's been inspired by many people. And I want to thank all of those people who've worked with me and given me opportunities, and the University of Otago, for all the opportunities that that's given for us to work together. And here's a few people, but I begin with a huge apology if anyone I've forgotten. We've got the Fiji team here, and my advisor, Khaleesi, who told me I had to get a long skirt and told me exactly how long it needed to be. We've got our students, and we've got the... These... I can't have all the students on, sorry, there's too many. But what we do have here is some of our lovely students, some of our planning students. We've also got some geography students, but we've got Anthony here, who designed the GIS for the Natural Neighbourhood Study. We've got Lynn Carter here and Janet Stevenson, who I've worked with on natural resource management papers. We've got here Aviva and Catherine, who worked with on a natural neighbourhood study. We've got Karen and we've got Megan, who are here with us, who worked on the Christchurch earthquake study. We've got... I looked at this and I thought there's a shortage of blokes. So we have got Paul, who's worked with me in many capacities. Paul is in Australia, and we've co-authored on several books and projects. We've got my planning colleagues here, and thanks to them, who I've worked with for many years now. We've got Christine here, Christine Bradshaw, Michelle, and Roz. Thanks to my planning colleagues. And we've got geography colleagues. I haven't fitted you all on, but this is a photograph from one of the best events that we ever have in geography, and this is the Bake Off. And we're all wearing our African aprons here with Nelson Mandela. And all, again, we've got postgraduate students. And we've got Marjorie, and she said I can use her photograph and use her name. She's standing in for all those people who've given their time to be interviewed and to talk to us as part of our study. We've got a couple of people who can't be with us anymore. We've got the wonderful Diane Campbell-Hunt, who was one of the great initiators at Orakanui and has been a lasting source of inspiration on all things ecological. We've got Anne Smith here, who sadly passed away this year and was a great mentor. I met her about 2 weeks after I arrived at Otago in the Children's Issues Centre, and she's always been a great mentor to me and sadly missed. We've got some of the key people I work with here, We've got Deborah, Kathy, Landa, and Christina, who I'm still working on projects with. But last but by no means least, we've got children. And what we see here is Govinda interviewing one of our children. And our children enjoy, well, they seem to. They seem to enjoy talking to us and wanting to share with us. And we can see this great joy that we've got in this child's face here. She's clearly enjoying talking to Govinda and explaining whatever she's explaining to him. So thank you to all of those people, and to my huge apologies to anyone I've left off, and to all those students who I couldn't fit on the photographs. Sorry. And then there's just a few special people. Some of them are with us and some of them aren't with us. And Tony's already mentioned the little Saul here who arrived. And I fortunately, he arrived early. He was in a rush, so I got to see him when I went to a conference in Britain. And Saul will be part of our next generation. And it's for Saul and all those others that we need to plan our cities. And for Saul, his first little nature contact will be the herring gulls who nest on his roof. But I couldn't get the parents and the little one to be together. The little one kept running off, so I had to borrow someone else's photograph. But they're apart. So even little Saul, who's very hardly been out of the house, is having that little nature contact. And as ever, there are rabbits. They're still there. They're still part of our life. And I'd like to leave you with a big thanks. And this photograph here, and this is what we can do. This was a coal yard in the 1980s. It was turned into a nature reserve in the late 1980s. It's literally 2 to 3 minutes walk from the Channel, from the Eurostar at King's Cross. It's not even 2 minutes. It's right there. It's been threatened many times with development. I think it's probably safe now. If anyone goes to King's Cross Station, go to Camley Street Nature Park. I was fortunate enough at the conference to be able to borrow a Boris bike, although the Santander bikes now, and cycle off to just check the nature reserve is doing all right. And I had a little nature experience. I was cycling along, and there was apes, and then there was giraffes. I went past London Zoo. But there are wonderful things in our cities, and thank you very much. Thank you for coming.
Tena koutou katoa. My name is Tony Ballantyne, and I'm the Provost Chancellor Humanities here at the University. And it's with great pleasure that I will deliver a vote of thanks to Professor Freeman. I think Claire has delivered a truly excellent lecture, providing rich insights into the development of her research, and she's taken us on a journey with her through many of her research projects. A set of very important arguments thread through the lecture. I think one of them was the relationship between cities and the world of nature, the interplay between flora and fauna and our built environments. And I think Claire is really encouraging all of us to think about our environments and our cities in ways that challenge many common sense understandings that, of course, are built on a dichotomy between the built and the natural worlds. She has also drawn our attention to the ways in which age mediates relationships with built environments and with nature. And I think that is a crucial line of argument. In many parts of the social sciences and humanities, questions relating to age have often been overshadowed by other ways of thinking and defining difference and community. That is unfortunate, I think, and Claire's talk tonight has really underlined the crucial insights that are produced when we take age and the life cycle seriously. And of course, Professor Freeman ended with the key argument about the importance of the everyday, everyday sites, everyday processes and practices, and their centrality in our research. Through tackling the everyday, researchers can make crucial interventions, not only by explaining the meaning of practice and the operation of our social systems, but they can also actually reshape the world that we live in. That, of course, is a central concern for the kind of socially engaged planning scholarship that is central to Claire's research and to her professional practice and teaching. So the kind of work that Claire does as a researcher and a teacher helps us better understand the societies and communities that we live in, and she has pointed us to some very important pathways into the future. Her talk has also demonstrated the great value of collaboration and has provided a vivid account of how her own research has been shaped by her co-investigators, her research subjects, and the sites where she has conducted her work. What has come across, I think, incredibly strongly is the operation of an incredibly generous and open mind. Claire is a highly valued member of the planning program, the Department of Geography, the Division of Humanities, and the university community as a whole. And we are all delighted to be here this evening to listen to Claire's reflections, and it is great to be here as a collective to celebrate her promotion. So could you please join with me in thanking Claire in 1 second? And after that, would you please join us in the staff club for some refreshment? So, Claire.